Welcome to Playback Daily for Wednesday, the 30th of March. I'm Gemma Craddock, and coming up, find out what this nugget has to do with our national obsession with chippers.
He took part in the 1905 mutiny on the Potemkin, and he fled west through Turkey and made his way eventually to Ireland. And he was arrested and he was interned in the Curragh camp on suspicion of being a German spy.
We hear how wildly short of the mark this estimation was.
Would you care to hazard a guess about how many coffee cups go to landfill every year?
Oh, I think it's something up in 1 million, 2 million, I'm not sure.
And Anne Higgins remembers the incomparable Michael Stokes.
Not many people wake up in the morning giddy with excitement when there's actually nothing happening. And we would look at him and say, why are you so excited? He says, I'm just excited for my life.
But let's start back at the beginning of the day. Our Emerald Isle's green credentials are shamefully unimpressive, but Ireland now wants to become the first country in the world to eliminate the use of disposable coffee cups. We bin a whopping 200 million coffee cups every year, and a levy is one of the actions included in the Circular Economy Bill. On Morning Ireland, Sinead Spain heard what commuters had to say about this.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea that would encourage people to bring their own cups and just reduce waste.
And would you regularly buy a coffee in a disposable cup?
Yes.
Do you think that the levy would make you bring your cup?
Definitely make me bring my own cup with me.
So. Would you care to hazard a guess about how many coffee cups go to landfill every year?
Oh, I think it's something up in 1 million, 2 million, I'm not sure.
200 million.
Wow, okay. That's crazy.
I think for the environment, I suppose, it makes sense. So obviously people just have to bring in their own coffee and stuff like that. So,
would you regularly buy a coffee?
I naturally sometimes would, but it'll probably make me rethink now, I suppose, on purchasing one.
Do you use a keep cup?
No. I do have one, but I haven't used it yet.
And might it encourage you to use one?
It would. It definitely would, yeah.
Yes, probably is a good idea. I don't think anyone would be too bothered by an extra 20 cent, I'd imagine. Yeah. I don't think I would anyway.
I see you're here with Dublin City Council emptying bins and cleaning the streets. And we're talking this morning about the levy on coffee cups that's due to come in later this year. How much of the rubbish that you would see would be coffee cups and teacups and that kind of stuff?
Could be 10 to 20% of the rubbish would be coffee cups and tea and that sort of thing. And plastic, mostly plastic waste.
Joining Mary Wilson to further discuss the matter was Minister of State with responsibility for communications and the circular economy, Oisin Smith.
Tell us about how you propose to do it. Tell us about the levy and how it'll be phased in and the cups phased out.
Well, we need to get approval from the European Union first for this, so that'll take about 3 months because they want to know that we're not interfering in the single market. So once we get a licence to go ahead and do this, I expect that that will take till towards the end of the year, so that towards the fourth quarter of the year before we can actually, you'll see it actually happen when you go to a cafe. So there'll be plenty of time during the summer to get used to using a keep cup. And, I have a collapsible keep cup that goes flat into my pocket, and there are also smaller ones for a flat white. So there are lots of practical ways to do this. It doesn't have to be, a big difficulty. Mm. And it's very similar to the plastic bag levy. So people will remember when that came in, we were using a giant number of plastic bags. And after the levy came in, the reduction was 95% in the use of plastic bags.
So you're hoping for something similar here.
I am hoping not to collect money from this levy. I am hoping that there will be such a reduction that in fact most people will switch over.
And anecdotally, it would appear, and before the COVID and before the pandemic, I had a keep cup, mm-hmm. and we reverted, I think, back to disposable cups during the pandemic. So we need to go back again. But how much will the levy be?
It's going to be 20 cents for a start. If we go back to the start of the pandemic, and there was certainly not very much knowledge about how the virus was passed on. Yeah. And so one of the things that happened was people stopped using keep cups. Mm. But in fact, the public health advice that I've been given by our public health division is that keep cups are fine, are safe, are not a significant risk, and that you can use them. So I would say to people that, you know, and you remember during the pandemic, everything started being wrapped in plastic and nobody
That's
wants
right.
to touch anything. But now we're aware that it's that, you know, the airborne nature of this virus. So.
It isn't just about keep cups, this circular economy bill. It's also about other single use disposable products. What do you mean by the circular economy?
It's just the difference between the way we have run our society up to now, which is to dig things out of the ground, make them into something, use them up and then dispose them, burn them or put them into landfills. So that's the linear economy. Mm-hmm. And instead, we want to make sure that the waste that we produce in society is considered to be a resource and feeds back into the rest of the economy so that we're not throwing away things and we're not always having to extract new materials to make the goods and services that we need. And one of the reasons to do this, not just for climate action, but also it makes us more independent and self-sufficient as a nation. So we're not dependent on imports of raw materials to run our society.
And part of doing this is the introduction of changes for commercial waste. People mightn't have been aware that, unlike domestic waste, commercial waste wasn't sorted at source.
Well, it's not mandatory to source it, is the thing. I mean, many companies are very conscientious about this, and it usually doesn't cost them more, you know. So the removal of green bins and brown bin waste is usually cheaper than black bin waste. But some companies have just put everything into a black bin for convenience and have paid the higher charges. So what we're saying is that in the same way that domestic waste collectors must provide segregated waste collection, that we're going to require that for companies, for businesses as well. So there isn't a free pass to segregate your waste if you're a company. And I think a lot of companies are doing this already, and we consulted with them very carefully to make sure that this wouldn't be a problem, worked with the Irish Waste Management Agency, worked with the stakeholders, and I think that they will be happy to work with
us. And you'll be empowering local authorities as well to be able to use CCTV footage to bring prosecutions to stop illegal dumping, stop flight dumping.
This has been a problem in the past, because at a beauty spot where there is regular black spot littering and dumping, local councils have tried to collect the evidence they need to convict people and have found that they run up against privacy laws and data protection laws. So they needed legislation to underpin this. So that now a local authority will have the power to put in CCTV in a specific place for a specific purpose. It's going to be very limited, because I don't want mass surveillance coming out of this. So they will be allowed to collect information, for example, a car registration number of somebody who is either dumping for profit, which people do, or else just littering.
But you know,
and we'll
what,
be able
Minister,
to send them a fine.
People will get to know where the cameras are, and they'll just tip where the cameras are not there.
I think that there are black spots. There are litter black spots. We won't be able to 100% eliminate it, but there are litter black spots. And at the moment, even in places where we know that regular dumping goes on, it's been very difficult to use CCTV for evidence. So I think this is absolutely needed.
Minister Oisin Smith on Morning Ireland. On this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show, we heard from Lucy Easthope, author of When the Dust Settles, Stories of Love, Loss and Hope from an Expert in Disaster. And Lucy began by explaining just what exactly her job entailed.
So I work in a field called disaster planning. So we plan for if a disaster occurs, we respond when it happens. And then in my particular part of the role, I very much think about afterwards. And a lot of my work is with the bereaved and the survivors and the communities affected.
It is the most peculiar job, if that's the... Well, that's not the right word, but let's go with that for the moment. Because, as you say, you help to run investigations, build mortuaries, oversee identification and burials and personal effects and repatriations. You describe it rather pithily as a Cinderella service sweeping up below the stairs.
Absolutely. And people just don't know about it. You know, there's a huge community of emergency planners and disaster planners right there in Ireland. You know, you have a strong history of it, and an Emergency Management Institute Ireland that protects and trains those professionals. But people just don't know it's there.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, I love coming to Ireland. And you have three universities that support people, but particularly Dublin City is one of the
right.
world's centres of excellence for disaster management training. And people just don't know necessarily that it's happening. And so the book was about really shining a light on not just a hidden world, but a place of incredible, I think, hope and industry. You know, people are working all the time to help communities.
OK, we've got to go to some pretty ghoulish places here. We'll do it in a second, but I just was intrigued by little you, young you, you know, growing up and, you know, 11 years old, looking at the news, I definitely felt a kindred spirit with you, because I would have been a bit like that as a kid, looking at the news and wondering why, who, what, where, when, and the big connections with history. So it was the Hillsborough disaster. You were 11 years old. It's 1989. As a Liverpool native, you're looking at this thinking, what? 11 years old.
I'm just appalled. You know, I'm very much absorbing the pain of people who were at the game. I wasn't at the game, but I was in a class with several young boys who were at the game. And I'm absorbing that pain and that frustration. And then what gets a lot worse, as of course we know, is that the community affected by the disaster are then sort of blamed for it. And I think, you know, one of the earliest memories I have is my dad sort of shouting at the telly, a very proud Scouser, and, you know, that somebody needed to sort this. And I very much took that as a directive and became a child activist. And I've met many of those, actually, since I've worked in disasters all my life and since then. And I've met many children who go on to focus on things like law and politics and community work and social justice because of their early experiences.
So how do you get from an interest in this as a child, writing to government ministers, writing to Mother Teresa, going to lectures about Chernobyl as a youngster, then getting into this the job you described a few minutes ago?
Yeah, so I decided to study law. You know, I was going to change this system from within. I was going to protect families. I was going to make sure that the bereaved and the deceased, so a huge part of my work has been coronial law and the care of the deceased. I was going to change the system from within. So I did a law degree, and then I got a position at a firm that few people know about, really, which is a private disaster management firm that's called by governments and armies and companies when the worst happens. And all of a sudden, I'm working on the response to 9/11 from Britain. We were sending teams over, and it was my job to manage those teams.
Okay, we'll go to 9/11 in a moment, but I want to get a kind of a broader sense, if I can, Lucy, of which you write. So you by the way, you write really, really well on this. It's so engaging. And you say, you know, I look for the doorway to hell. And you've got Jay, your driver that you use, who's got a particular skill in getting closer to the police tape than anyone else. You're listening to what are you listening to on your iPod as part of your ritual, and what are you looking to, what do you find yourself doing as you approach any scene?
Yeah, so I've always used music as a soundtrack, actually. It was a very early coping skill. I remember chatting to the screenwriter, Jimmy McGovern, about it, that he always thinks of the soundtrack for his very powerful productions first, and music's always been so important. So I play things like Eminem and Kanye, or I also use a few show tunes, even a bit of Jerry Marsden. And
right.
My favourite one at the moment is I have the Blood Brothers soundtrack on, for those of the fan of the Liverpool musical.
Yeah.
And it just sort of gets you in the mood for what you're going to have to do and what you're going to have to see.
What's the music? You say it gets you in the mood, like a show tune or Kanye. There's a big difference there, obviously, but what is the music doing to your neurons?
I think it's a very sort of primitive feel, isn't it? Music's really important. And it's really important for people at the moment, actually, who are feeling quite drained and exhausted by the pandemic. One of the fast things that we do with disaster responders and disaster survivors is ask them to come up with their playlist that's going to get them through this week. So, you know, one of the things I'm really, really important is the ability to turn on a tune really loud. And that's one of the coping strategies we use, actually. So All credit to the radio shows for allowing us to do that.
All right, so you listen to your music, you get out of the car, you've got a rucksack or a wheelie suitcase. I was going to say wheelie bin, but you definitely don't have that. You have a wheelie suitcase, and you're looking for the doorway to hell, as we describe. Tell me about that approach to that doorway, and what you're A, looking for, and B, what you expect to see.
Yeah, so one thing about the book is we're really shining a light on a world that people don't understand. So I'm not a responder. So one of the points about really making it clear that it's a bit of a step into that place is I've got to make the case for why I'm there. So I'm usually called in by the police or by the coroner, but I'm not a blue light responder. And you know that when you go into that world, you're going to see something very different. So in a few instances, that's the scene. But usually for me, it's either the mortuary or particularly graphic specifically, I talk about what's called the personal effects warehouse, which is where we keep the items from the scene and retrieve from the deceased, which my work has often been to try and protect those and get them returned to the families, which is something that many families have experience of, both with you know, major incidents, but also any sudden loss.
You're a very straight shooting approach to dead bodies. You say, I've never been afraid of the dead. I think of them as my kin. And you talk about the beauty of decomposition.
Absolutely.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, my work over the years has been informed by so many different disciplines, and there's a sort of spiritual element to it. And I work with a lot of religious leaders after disaster, and also with people like forensic anthropologists. And so you are put into situations with sudden death where you see the body in quite damaged situations. And I've always, I think, just been able to empathise with perhaps what I'm seeing, and then make arrangements in the same way as, you know, there's a long history of the care of small relics and remains, make arrangements for the families to have those back. And that's been one of my proudest jobs. But it is very, very hidden, you know, and people are very curious about it, but they don't always understand the pride that we take.
Yeah, you were talking about the 9/11 attacks. I want to go there for a moment, because it was recently, not too recently, but at the museum at the site of the Ground Zero, where part of the things they show there now are bits of seatbelt and maybe papers that came out of some of the buildings. And it's eerie, but it's all part of, these are kind of the sort of things you'd be looking at. But in the case of a disaster like this, you're looking for personal effects rather than something else that I've just described. So talk to me about your 9/11 experience and what your involvement was there.
So I was responsible for sending British teams out to work at the site in the mortuary, retrieving exactly those objects that you describe. And they're very similar to what you describe there. The 9/11 attacks were the first time we'd had a forensic operation on this scale, and a promise had been made to return every possible part to a loved one. And that resulted in over 22,000 body parts. So the Office of Chief Medical Examiner hired a private contractor and to support them, and we supplied both equipment and teams. And that was an ongoing rolling operation, and that was probably one of the first major insights into how much work goes into the aftermath of caring for the deceased and their remains, but also the negotiations that you're doing with the bereaved and the survivors. And people just don't think about that. But there's a huge comfort, I think, about knowing that there's people like me who do. So that was the first big test of that, I think.
There was a scene you talk about, and it's not unrelated to 9/11, but it's 7/7, which wasn't too far after and very close to home where you are, and indeed to where we are. And the Metropolitan Police, as you recall, began to allow survivors to say goodbye to their limbs. I don't want to be prurient, and I don't want to be hurtful or distasteful, but this is a fact of life, and this is a fact of your job.
Absolutely. And this is what I call the bricolage, you know, the hidden work that goes on. And these are all people, you know, that we have to think about when we're working. And I, you know, I use that story, I think, as an example of the consideration that's been given behind closed doors. It's also an example of how we've evolved and changed over years. You know, things like battlefield and disaster honesty. We're much more transparent now with people, hopefully. We don't always get it right still, but hopefully we'll tell people what we found and what we might be able to do with them. And, you know, many of the colleagues that I work with over the years, they've had to explain things that are incredibly difficult to families. But you learn to be very transparent and open about that. So those stories help me explain, you know, the work that goes into talking to a family about that. And I hope we've been able to bring some comfort there.
And did you get much uptake in that? Did people want to say goodbye to body parts or to try and make that connection? Or were they repulsed by the idea?
So we see different reactions from different groups.
Yeah.
So living survivors will often, take part in that. You know, it's not dissimilar to other examples of medical procedures, you know, where people have amputations, for example. With the dead, what it taught me was that we what's so important is individual choice if we can. And that's probably one of the overwhelming lessons from my book, is however big the disaster, try and keep individual choice as a possibility. And we've lost that a little bit with the pandemic. You know, there were blanket policies on what was possible. And we may even see it with things like the refugees, that people think, you know, one policy fits all. And the most important thing is to weigh up your options, which is something that I do, look at the resources needed, mm-hmm. and then sit with families to explain what might be possible.
One of the other aspects of your job that I found fascinating was the returning of personal effects to the families of the deceased. And again, back to the Met Police, at one point they had this, they went through a phase of wrapping items in recycled paper that had been pulped with wildflowers. People will be familiar with this type of box or paper. Tell me why that didn't work.
Yeah, so it's one of those examples of where, people will think of something that's lovely and then the disaster planners come in and go, are you sure? You know, and there's a lot of that in my career. So we tend to advise, a very plain cardboard box, but the Metropolitan Police wanted to use something a bit more fancy, and it was a sort of artisan box with pulped red and green flowers. And the families interpreted that when they got the box, there was bits of blood and ash in the box. So it's things like just trying to perceive how things might land. Again, I think there's a huge comfort from thinking about, there's somebody thinking about how this will be returned. I do talk about in the book, you know, sometimes things are just returned in a black bin bag or in an evidence bag. And, you know, I really try and fight that. That's much worse.
The letters, I mean, this is again something, you know, watching the war in Ukraine and the coverage of it, I don't know if you feel the same way, Lucy, but watching the digging trenches or, ringing their mothers, war is war, century in, century out. It could be ancient Rome, it could be World War II, it could be Ukraine 2022. And I was struck by the emphasis you put on letters. If you wouldn't mind talking me through this a little.
So I refer to letters at several points in the book, and one of those is that when we were repatriating the soldiers from Iraq, one of the things they weren't supposed to do was have identifying items with them, but they kept their letters from home in their underwear. And the first couple of repatriations, there was a danger that those were being thrown away. So I made a very fast representation that we'd be allowed to keep those and return them to the families. And that, I don't always, you know, get to hear the story afterwards. I don't always get the feedback. But in that case, I've seen several widows actually on news programmes talk about what it meant to know that their loved one had received the letter. And so they just looked like little tiny scrunched up pieces of paper. But we were able to dry them out and preserve them and return them. And that's the essence of personal effects. You don't know what will mean something to somebody. And often it's the very, very non expensive items. It's the chewed biro in the 9/11 museum that you talk about. There's a till receipt that shows that somebody had breakfast, and it means the world to that mother because she knows at least the son had breakfast on that day. Those are the sorts of things that I return, and they bring huge comfort.
You speak with a great heart about situations that have often been caused by great heartlessness or stupidity or cruelty. So how do you manage to marry those parts of your brain to not get too close and yet to want to make sure that the people of the families of the deceased have something full of heart in their lives after the event?
That's a lovely description. Thank you very much. It is difficult. That's when the really big show tunes come out, you know, to keep it going.
Right. You're into Hamilton then, are you?
When you're into all the musicals, you know it's getting tough. Okay. It is very difficult, but there's so much hope. And the thing is about disaster planning, we always see the very best of people as well as the very worst, and that's what keeps us going.
Mm. I want to mention briefly Grenfell, because that really a story, you know, it not that it hit home here, but it certainly featured in our news coverage, and it was so upsetting. And it struck me that you talk about Iraq, you talk about 7/7, you talk about 9/11, you talk about all these different places and scenes you've seen, but I get the sense that Grenfell really might have even got under your skin.
They all leave their mark. But Grenfell, as you say, very much fits with your last question. It was a complete systemic failure, and I think really for English disaster planners, it was our darkest day. We were devastated by both the fact that it had even happened, but also that we weren't allowed to bring our best tools and skills to the job. It was incredibly difficult to respond to that disaster, and I'm in awe of that community, and that's what I also do with the book, is I make it very clear, you know, for the people of North Kensington, that disaster is as acute today as it was 5 years ago, and they need as much support as they did then. And these disasters don't go anywhere. That's the overwhelming point. They ebb and they flow, and they have good days, and maybe there's a day to smile. But like all types of bereavement and terrible pain, the community's struggle goes on. So I hope the book shines a bit of a light on that.
And Lucy's book is When the Dust Settles, Stories of Love, Loss and Hope from an Expert in Disaster. And she was chatting there to Ryan Tuberty. Doolin has always been a hotspot, but 330 million years ago, Doolin enjoyed an equatorial climate with diverse flora and fauna. And on Morning Ireland, Mary Wilson spoke to Dr. Eamon Doyle, geologist for the Burren and Cliffs of Moher UNESCO Global Geopark, about his incredible discovery.
It's hard to get your head around an ancient Earth going back 330 million years. What did you find, and what's the significance of what you found?
Well, what I found was a series of burrows in the limestone. So they look very much like what you would find in the Bahamas today, where you get shrimp burrowing just offshore. So they live in these burrows. They dig down a little bit into the mud on the seafloor, basically, and they live in them. And they, you know, they pump water in and out, and they get their food in and out of those burrows. And the significance of it, I guess, is that usually shrimp or shrimp-like creatures like that, they're very soft. They don't get preserved as fossils. So when we find fossils, we usually find the hard parts of them, and they're the ones bits that are most likely to preserve. But shrimp and other creatures like that don't have many hard parts. So generally, and not just in Ireland, they're very rare. It's very rare to find fossil creatures like that, the soft-bodied creatures, globally, particularly at that age, you know, 330 million years ago, a long time ago. So to find the burrows, we know they were there. So we got evidence of these living creatures, even though we don't find the creatures themselves. And that adds to the biodiversity of the fossil fauna that we know at that time.
Modern Clare was near the equator 330 million years ago. How do these burrows add to the sum of our knowledge about ancient Earth?
Yeah, so we've come on an awful long journey. I had my evening course last night, and I was telling the guys about that, so a big shout out to them. So we've come from the equator, and it's taken 300 million years to get where we are now. But the fossils that were living in the rocks then, or the creatures that were living at that time down near the equator, they got preserved in the rocks, and they were carried up with that journey. And then when they're exposed on the coast by storms or whatever, as a geologist, you know, and I big shout out to Geological Survey of Ireland and Clare County Council who support me in this work, I get to find them. And when I find them, I have to know what they are. And we do research. So I work with Dr. Paddy Orr in UCD and John Murray in NUIG. And we did an in-depth study on these things. And what they do is they add to the overall picture of what kind of animals were living at that time. And that's really important to understand how the limestones evolved. And the limestones, of course, are so important to the geology and the landscape of the burn. So lots of tourists come here just to look at not just the Cliffs of Moher, but also the limestone, the burn. And we add to that story, and we add, you know, added value to what the people here know about their sure. their geological heritage.
Dr. Eamon Doyle on Morning Ireland. It's a topic that elicits strong feelings and can divide families and even communities. Politics? No. GAA? Nope. It's chips. Chipper chips. The best way to eat them, exactly, and the best places to get them. And Claire Byrne opened and closed the discussion fairly promptly.
Can you ever have too much vinegar? No is the answer to that one. That one's sorted already. Lise Hand, journalist, broadcaster, restaurant reviewer for the Sunday Times, is with us, along with FM 104 DJ Thomas Cross, who we all know as Crossy. And you're both going to give us your take on what makes a good chipper. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, Claire.
Lise, where do you stand on the old vinegar debate?
Oh, I mean, I'm very firm on this. You absolutely cannot have too much vinegar. I mean, you wait until they stop pouring and then you say, can I have some more? And I mean, if the bag is still intact by the time you get to the end of it, you haven't got enough vinegar in it, essentially.
Okay, and that's another brings me to another question, Crossy. The bag, the brown paper bag with the white paper inside it. I mean, that's one of the most important elements of a good chipper, isn't it?
And you know what the best thing about it as well is that the white bag has to be smaller than the brown bag. So they throw in that extra scoop of chips. I know there's one place that I went to before in Navan. I remember they used to fill the brown bag up with chips. Like, I haven't seen that in many places. It's usually the white bag and a little scoop. But imagine filling the whole bag. You kind of feel like you have two bags of chips in one.
Yeah, you're always watching for the level of the fill, aren't you? This is killing
Absolutely.
Me now, because on Monday I went for a walk and I walked past somebody who was eating chips on the seafront lease, and I'm not the better of it still. Like, the smell is just something else, isn't it?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, I'd say actually by the end of this item, a few people will be cursing you, Claire, and dumping their quinoa and kale salads to head out to the local chipper. Yeah, you know, and I think actually part of the pleasure of if you buy, say, a bag of chips and you're driving home is that smell in the car, which I love. And
even the next day?
Yeah, no, it's still fine because it's just redolent of a good night. And a good feed, so I've never any problem smelling chips the next day in the car.
Well, we go back a little bit because the history behind the Irish chipper, all those names that we know and associate with the great Italian chippers, they come from one small place in Italy, is that right?
That's right, yeah. I mean, it's actually, the history is fascinating. I mean, we all know the names like Forte and Macari and Borza and Cafola and Fusco, and they all come from a small region in Lazio, and it's sort of like it's six villages. It's Casalatico. It's sort of a district of six villages and about halfway between Rome and Naples. And they all originally came here. I mean, there was two main reasons. One was, again, it's something probably familiar to a lot of Irish people living in rural Ireland, that the land got subdivided until it became unusable. The lots became unusable. And there was a sort of second wave then, just after the Second World War, because the area was very near Monte Cassino, which was absolutely devastated during the war. And but the original chipper, I suppose you'd call him pioneer, his name is Giuseppe Cervi, and legend has it that he stepped off an American bound boat by accident, which had stopped in Cove, found himself in Ireland and just basically started walking until he hit Dublin. And he eventually, he kind of, you know, did a few labouring jobs and so on, and then eventually opened up a permanent chipper on Great Brunswick Street, which is now Pier Street. And the interesting thing about that is his wife, Palma, would ask customers, una di questo, uno di quello, which means one of this and one of the other. And by doing so, coined the phrase, the one and one, which, you know, again, as anybody, you know, it's a real Dublin phrase, you go and ask for a one and
brilliant.
One.
Brilliant. I love that story.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant.
One of this and one of the other.
And one of the other. And of course, that they weren't all, I mean, the names aren't all purely Italian. And we had, you know, Patrick and Bella Burdock from Christchurch, who of course opened Burdock's, a few chippers around town, and the original one in Werburgh Street is still going strong. They named the chipper after their son Leo Burdock's, and I mean it stayed open through the Rising and through the wars and everything, the one in Werburgh Street, and has fed a clatter of celebrities. And of course we've Beshov's as well, and Ivan Beshov was actually a Ukrainian immigrant, and he took part in the 1905 mutiny on the Potemkin, and he fled west through Turkey and made his way eventually to Ireland. And he was arrested and he was interned in the Curragh camp on suspicion of being a German spy. And once he was sprung, he set up a chip shop down on Dublin's North Strand, which ironically then was bombed by the Germans in 1941. But of course, he rebuilt, and of course, it became a huge Dublin institution. So, you know, that's sort of the history of, you know, of
it's,
chippers.
It's
absolutely
really interesting.
Yeah, really
and of
interesting.
Course, in all of our families, we have our relationships and the history of our relationships with the chipper. Crossy, what's yours in your house?
Oh, I remember, right? So back, I'd say in the late 90s, my dad had a job, and then he had a job out the back garden straight afterwards, you know, trying to make ends meet. And I remember every Thursday night, it was only a little fella, I knew when he was finished up, he'd go down to the local chipper and he'd get himself onion ring and chips for himself and my mum. So I was only a little fella. So I started, you know, waking up naturally at about 11 o'clock at night and running down. And I got to a stage then where I was enjoying chips on a Thursday night and on a Friday night, because every Friday night in our house, we were having a chipper. And I say this to people, I find it strange when people don't get chippers once a week. I adore them. I gig all around Ireland, and I'll always find out what the chipper is when I'm on stage. I'm like, does anyone know what the best chipper is around here? And everybody has one in each town that they're like,
what do you order now in the weekly chipper run? Crossy, what do you get?
I live in Donnybrook, and the one up beside me is Romeo's. So I just say, get a chicken burger and chips. But I also get something for the drive home, because you don't want to have a chipper, right? And this, because you're always ravenous. So I get a portion of onion rings, or I get a batter sausage, and I have that on the drive home. So when I get to sit down and relax in front of the television, I have myself a chipper. Now, it was bad when Operation Transformation was on, because I always seem to watch it during that, or eat during that, or even when that program was on, Ireland's Fittest Family. And I was like, this is awful. I should not be doing this.
And are you okay now from the, you know, when you're getting out of the car and you're going into the house, you don't need anything to eat for that part of the journey. That's okay. You're okay for that.
Don't give me ideas. Don't give me ideas.
Lise, what do you order if you go for the chips?
I must say, I'm a bit of a purist. I tend to just go for a fairly, at the classic, which would be cotton chips or a Ray and chips. I'm very fond of a bit of Ray as well. And I was actually very interested, because one of the two, I had a Borza quite close to me, but it's unfortunately shut down. So I'd use Presto up on Bath Avenue and in Irishtown, or Ferrari down Ring's End. And that's when they're about 100 years, though I presume it didn't start off like being called a Ferrari. But of course, Ring's End used to be known as Raytown. That was what it was called, because the poor population there used to eat ray wings, which were considered, you know, sort of just the sort of the scrag end of the fish, if to mix a metaphor. So they would actually take the ray wings and they'd dry them, and they'd essentially sort of sun dry them, and so they'd become cured, and they could feed a family for days on end. But you know, for a long time, the ray was sort of considered a bit of sort of, you know, not the greatest fish. But my God, a bit of ray and a bit of batter now, you can't beat it.
Yeah, and you came across something unusual, Crossy, didn't you? A 3-in-1 in a tray from a chipper in Thomas Street. I know you post on social media. What was in that?
Oh, wow. So what they've done was, right, they got, you know, the tray, a normal tray. They put the chips in it. They get the chipper curry sauce, which is the proper chipper curry sauce. And they got a batter sausage, chopped it all up, mixed it all in together. It's a place called Vincenzo's on Thomas Street. And it's unreal. It's just revolutionary. And I said it to someone, they're like, oh, that's just, why didn't you just get chips, curry sauce and a batter sausage and do it yourself?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, it came from the chipper. When you go to the chipper, you don't want any hassle. You don't want anything fancy. You don't want to be, you know, having to sit down with, you know, a shirt and tie on. This is comfort food. And we all love a bit of comfort food. And oh, look, I'm telling you, I could write a book. I felt like this was my moment today, because chippers are just
this is
brilliant.
Your specialist subject. And where do you stand on the spice bag?
See, a spice bag should never be made in an Irish chipper. And I think any Irish chippers who try and recreate it, I'm like, lads, leave that to the Chinese takeaways. They're the ones that get the proper. If you know what a Chinese food and chippers are completely different. Like, the chips are completely different. If you go into a proper chipper, they're chunky, they're proper, they're golden in colour, and you can throw the salt and vinegar on them. But I find with Chinese chips, they're skinny. Do you know what? They're great for your chicken curries and all that. They're not good for your chipper chippers.
Yeah, you see, by the same token, should you say to the Chinese takeaway, you shouldn't be doing the chips? You know, is that what you're saying? You've got to leave each to their own.
I like them. I like them. No, I like them because they're different. They're skinny chips. They're really, really skinny chips. And they work well with the curry sauce and the chicken. And then when you're having the spice bag, I find with the chipper chips, they have to be chunky. If you're an authentic chipper, they're chunky chips.
Okay, so Lise, we've established now that vinegar is really important, getting that right. What you put it in is really important as well. Anything else that we need to look for when we're trying to decide where the best chipper is?
Well, probably the queue outside the door. Yeah, I'd say probably the queue outside the door is always a good sign. I mean, if you come up to a chipper, and not just say at closing time, which is of course the traditional dining time for a lot of people here, but you know, during the day, when you see a kid queuing up to get the fish for the dinner or the fish supper, that's always a good sign. I mean, I think if you go in and there's that lovely smell of vegetable, sort of, you know, sizzling vegetable oil as well. I mean, that's one thing the Italians did bring with them was, you know, cooking their chips in vegetable oil. And because it's interesting, because the sort of the route that a lot of the Italians took was sort of, was through England and up to Scotland. I mean, the Scots, as we all know, took to chips no end. I think by something like 1914, they had 4,500 chippers or something.
But they deep fry Mars bars.
They deep fry Mars bars. There were a couple of places that tried that. And apparently I saw online a couple of years ago, a chipper out in Ballyfermot was selling deep fried cream eggs as a Christmas special, which I would have definitely gone and tried.
I knew you would have had it. What was it like?
Do you know what? It just wasn't nice. It really wasn't nice.
Why am I not surprised to hear that? That's, you know, a cream egg in batter is just, it's too much. It's too much.
It is. And I think as well, the quality of the spuds here, of course, let's not forget that.
Yes.
I mean, we have Mars Pipers, which I know are the preferred spud of choice with a lot of chip shops and a lot of restaurants as well, because that's sort of lovely flowery kind of texture from it. And that comes through, you know, in a good chip as well.
Lise, Crossy, thank you both very much indeed. Getting messages on this, I have to be able to suck the vinegar out of the corner of the bag. No, that's just taking it too far. Tom says, chippers who put the fish on top of the chips in a box are an abomination. Soggy chips are no good to anyone. Oh my gosh, people are so particular about this. A good chipper always throws an extra few into the brown bag. Nothing worse than a mean bag of chips. I have to agree. There is nothing worse than a mean bag of chips. I'd love some now.
You and me both, Claire. Lise Hand and Crossy on Today with Claire Byrne. On the Ray Darcy Show in the afternoon, Anne Higgins, newly appointed principal of the Temple Street Children's Hospital School, explained that she had her eyes on the prize and knew that she was destined for the job. She'd been guided to it. And by whom? Well, this part of the story you might recognise.
So back in 2015 or thereabouts, you and your husband Barry,
that's right,
and Michael, who's your foster child,
yes,
featured on Room to Improve.
We did,
and Michael was a wheelchair user.
That's right,
and he stole the heart of the nation.
He did,
yeah, yeah,
and rightly so.
Oh my God! Oh my God! Oh my God!
Oh my God! Fancy dancing!
Fancy dancing! So people remember him, and then he featured on the Late Late Show, and he died then in 2018.
He did.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you're heartbroken.
Heartbroken.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you would have been in and out of Temple Street with Michael.
With Michael, yeah. Yes, over the years. So as soon as we got involved with Michael, which was around about age 7, anytime he had appointments in Temple Street, he really wanted us to bring him. He needed that, you know, mum and dad comfort with him in Temple Street. He had a condition called osteogenesis imperfecta, which is commonly known as brittle bone disease. It's a lot more complex than just brittle bones. But so he had very regular treatments, unfortunately, very regular fractures, and also just other appointments. So we were in and out of there. It was our second home. And I was blown away by, I suppose, how much love was given to him, but also how much love he had for Temple Street. At times before he lived with us, when he lived in residential care, I think he preferred staying in Temple Street, and he'd be trying to beg doctors and nurses, go on, let me stay another night, which is very unusual for a child in a hospital setting. So we have built up, I mean, when Michael was 7, that's back to 2009. So my relationship with Temple Street goes back quite a long way.
Of course, people remember him as this amazingly gregarious,
yeah,
12-year-old, yes,
yeah, that's right.
And I can see why in the hospital setting he would have been a bit of a star, I'd imagine, wasn't he?
100%. Yeah. Oh yeah, ruling the roost in there.
Yeah.
And what's lovely is he's still so well remembered in there, and I think he's in many ways still guiding people. And I'm told that there's photographs of Michael around the place. They're still very much guided by Michael in there. So people are asking, we all know John Doyle, the porter in Temple Street, and he will say, yeah, if I run it past Michael in the morning and I say to him, well, if it's, you know, I'm going to do it for you, and then it'll be the right thing to do.
Ah, that's lovely, isn't
it? But yeah, he had that effect on
people. So he's guided you to your job.
He has guided me to my job. And that might sound strange to some people, but I think anybody who's lost anybody, you know, very close to them, but especially a child, you know, he lives in my heart. But I feel him. I genuinely do feel him. I have had very strange and unusual things happen along the way that can only be explained by Michael.
Go on.
Oh, there's so many examples. There's a couple of songs, of course, that'll come up, but they'll come up at a time when I've actually asked him to let me know he's around me. And they aren't songs that maybe you would hear, generally speaking, on the radio. I've been in cafes when I've been upset and having a cup of coffee and thinking about him, and a song will come on and go, well, that's Michael. Down to finding things on the side of the road that, you know, you think that's a very strange thing for me to find right now. And I'm not talking about the feathers or I'm not talking about the robins. I'm talking about things. For example, Michael made up his own sayings. He had Michaelisms. His friends, if they're listening today, they'll be roaring laughing because they didn't make sense, but they were hilarious. And his favourite one was, because he was a very hot little creature, and his favourite saying was, geez, I'm sweating like a dolphin. Right. And who knows what dolphins sweat like, but he was sweating like one. And we were away we ran away to Spain about a week after Michael died. We just needed to run out of the country and be on our own. And we were in a town square in Marbella. And there was one of those mime artists. And Barry, being the big softy that he is, said, I feel sorry for those fellas. They're standing there in the heat and they're trying to. Nobody goes, I'm going to go up and give him a couple of euro. And he handed the guy a couple of euro. And the guy grabbed his hand and put something in it. And he closed his hand. Barry came back down and sat at the table, and it was a dolphin.
No way.
Yeah. And there's been lots of those sort of dolphin things that have happened. So, yeah, it's very upsetting, but it's also comforting.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's so because it's like, did you not feel a little bit spooked by that?
Not really, no. Because it's him.
Right.
So
okay.
not because it's Michael, no.
Let's go back then to your relationship with Michael and how it started. So he was in residential care.
He was.
And you were a teacher.
I was a teacher in the same building. So there was it was a hospital school. It's no longer a hospital school, but at the time the locals in Baldoyle would have called it Little Willie's, St Mary's Hospital. And that's where Michael lived from when he was a baby and came down to school when he was 3 years of age. This tiny, tiny little mite that just whispered. You could barely just whisper. You couldn't hear him at all. And to see him years later on the stage in the Helix Theatre, giving it socks, belting out songs, was just an incredible feat. It showed what inner resilience and strength he had. Mm. So when Michael was in my class, I fell in love with him immediately. I think a lot of people did. But I sort of vowed to do something. I felt the school wasn't the right placement for him. So I made a promise to him without him knowing that the first thing I was going to do was move him to a school that was more suitable. So we did that. And then on his 8th birthday, he had a party, and that was when Barry met him. And that's when everything changed.
Barry's your husband.
Barry's my husband.
Big softy.
Big softy. He loved that.
Well,
he's a big hard man.
No, but I was re-watching Room to Improve. And every time you went to talk about anything slightly emotional.
He's a bit emotional.
He had to get up and walk away because he didn't want to. Cry on television. Yeah.
I know, is a softie. He's great.
Yeah. So he fell in love as well.
Barry fell in love with Michael. Barry'd heard all about Michael, and he was fascinated because Michael was in this house at a party, and all he was doing was Anne. And he was just, Barry was, and we left the house that day, and Barry's words to me were, we have to do something. And I went, uh-oh. But sure, I was delighted, but it had to be the two of us together. So we set the wheels in motion, and it started off with us being allowed to take Michael out for, you know, a day trip out into town and have the crack. But over time, I mean, it went from, oh, Michael, we might do it once every 2 weeks to there was no way that was happening. It was happening every week.
Yes.
And then it became, can I not stay the night with you? Because he didn't really want to go back to where he was staying. He wanted to stay with us. So.
And he was loved by
both. Oh, sure. We adored him.
And there was that. So it was one night, and then he'd stay two nights. That was
a doubler. That was the doubler, yeah. Yes. And we sort of gently sort of moved the goalposts a wee bit and liaised with both the residential services that he was with and with his biological family. And over time, I suppose Michael learned to be very, very, very well spoken. And he would, I mean, very well good at speaking up for himself.
Oh, yes, yes.
He hadn't been previously. He was quite timid and I suppose nervous. And he had grown up in a setting where he didn't have a core family network around him. And he had just grown so, so good at speaking up for himself. And I think Michael made the decision. He just said, well, I want to live with you. And we're like, well, we want you here, so let's go and do something about it. And that was it. We changed everything.
And when we all were introduced to you and Michael in 2015 through Room to Improve, was he permanent fixture in the house at that stage?
Not at that stage. No. So that was a huge stepping stone. So at that stage, he had definitely moved on to Trebblers.
Right.
and every so often during school holidays, we might have snuck in another day or two. But we were very much still bringing the mattress downstairs into the sitting room, and we were all sleeping in the one room because he wouldn't let us leave him. And it wasn't ideal. The wheelchair barely fit through the front door. So we were... I mean, it was all meant to be. And I do believe even that was meant to be, that Room to Improve came along and did such a phenomenal job for us. Yeah. On as we were watching the current series, on a very tight budget.
And there's a great line in it where Michael delivers the... Because he delivered the line, what's the budget? And he said, 130,000. Yeah. 130,000 was the budget.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you ever watch that back?
No. Really. I find it quite hard to... I suppose if I feel like wanting to have a great old big cry, I think watching Michael's videos of him on anything, whether it's singing in the Helix or Room to Improve or when he was on RT or his own videos that I have on the phone and listening to his voice, I find listening to his voice just... You know, it's so emotional for me to listen to his voice. Yeah, it is. But I mean, I love it still. But I have to be ready. I have to be ready and sit
down.
It's
on your
and
terms.
Make a decision to do that.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it's 4 years on then.
Four years this on. May. Yeah.
So he would have been living permanently with you. You and Barry for how long? How many years? Two or three years.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So you were a family unit.
Oh, completely. I mean, you know, thank God we did all the brilliant things. Like we had a massive party for him when he moved in. And, you know, he couldn't believe it himself. He was actually interviewed by an American guy who runs a YouTube channel called Special Books for Special Children. And he was doing, Michael and myself used to watch the videos, and he was doing a tour of Ireland. And he said, I'm looking for Irish families. And again, we put our names in. And we were the only family picked. Like, it was all sort of meant to be, kismet or whatever you call it. So they came to our house, and now that is the most treasured video that we have, is that video clip of Michael being interviewed, because he did it in my absence. I had to sit in the other room, and it was so honest.
Like,
was,
what sort of questions was he?
I suppose
asked?
They asked Michael how he felt about living with us, and of course that was very honest. And he was things like, I can't actually believe it's come. My wishes have come true. My dreams have come true. And he was asked what was it like for him growing up in residential care, and he was very measured, and he just stopped, and his face changed, and he said, it wasn't the best.
Yeah.
And that was enough to be said, because Michael, you know, he had such a positive outlook in life. He didn't go there. He didn't go backwards. He didn't hold anything against anybody. He knew who his people were. He knew his tribe. He knew who he could trust. He could read. He could read your face. And if you smiled, but you didn't mean it, he would know straight away. Because he'd say to me, that person has a smile, but they don't seem happy.
You sort of, maybe that's a skill you have to develop when you're brought up in residential care.
That's exactly
who you can
trust
and who you...
You do. You have to read people. Yeah. And on top of that, if you have a very significant physical disability and you can't get yourself up away from people, you can't run away, you can't fight your own corner physically or any other way. And his condition was such that he had to be lifted very carefully by people. And if he wasn't lifted carefully, he'd break a bone. So he was very, very nervous of people. And there was a key.
So he had to get the measure of people so he could trust them.
So he could trust them. He had a core group of unbelievable carers at that time, who some of whom I'm still in touch with.
Yeah.
And they were his people at that time.
He died. Was it quickly in the end, or
unfortunately, Michael had an accident, and that was on the 16th of March, 4 years ago. So we're actually that time. And he was in ICU then for 7 weeks. So that was a horrendous time.
Oh God!
But again, his true fighting spirit. He fought and fought and fought. So we lived in Temple Street, and that's where the relationship between ourselves, I suppose, the care Michael got during that time it was always brilliant, but we saw a whole other side of Temple Street up in ICU and the care they gave. We lived in the hospital. We had a room in the hospital. We never went home. So they became our family.
Yeah.
So you can see where the strength of my relationship is
with them.
And
sort of, you feel, I suppose you feel like you owe them in a way.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just feel part of them too.
Yeah.
And I feel closer to him in
there. Yeah, but that's the thing. Yeah, and some people say that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah, I do.
So you're going into work then.
And I'm going into
constant
work.
Reminders of Michael there.
Yeah. So there's I'm only started last Monday week.
Right.
So there are a certain few pathways in the hospital that are a little bit triggering for me at the moment. So I'm taking them for the first time.
Okay.
And they can be a little bit challenging and certainly trigger points, but I'm aware of it. And I wouldn't have taken the job, unless I felt I could manage and get through that.
And now, 4 years since Michael's death, Anne has been guided back to Temple Street.
I'm only in the door. They've been so welcoming.
And is there an actual school?
So there's a school. There's a school office and like a teacher's meeting staff room, resource room, and a large classroom. And they're in one central place in the hospital. And then there's two satellite classrooms on the end of two of the wards. So teachers, come in the morning, gather, and then they'll have a look and see the admissions. Somebody said to me, it's almost like looking at the admissions in the hotel,
see
who went home,
who came.
And obviously there's a lot of predictability with some children
who are repeat
customers.
Yes, yeah.
Children are in and out a lot for things like hemodialysis, and there's other children that'll be there for long stays, and they'll be priority for teaching. And then
there's a lot of one-on-one then, is there?
Oh, lots of one-on-one, especially since COVID. The teachers would have taken children in small groups to the classroom, but at the moment that's not possible.
Yeah.
And that would be amazing if we could get back to that.
It's a specific type of teaching.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that requires a specific type of person.
They're magic. It wouldn't be for everybody. And obviously, post-primary teachers are sometimes obliged. They're trying to cover junior cycle subjects, and children might be preparing for exams and might be feeling very anxious that they're missing out. So those teachers would link closely with the child's base school at home.
Yeah.
And then for a lot of the other children, the teachers just spend a lot of time at first getting to know the children and seeing what they like, what do they enjoy, and start there. Start at the end of the day, they're sick.
The last thing you want to put them under is pressure, isn't
it?
Yes, yeah.
Look, their medical needs come first. That's priority first and foremost.
Now, Niamh has been on here. She says, myself and my daughter met Michael in Temple Street one Stephen's Day morning. And even though she was older than him, he comforted her.
Oh,
she met him again in the CRC when on work placement and told him the story, and he was delighted. That's Niamh. And I knew Michael. I was one of his nurses in CRC. He was the life and soul of the place. He was one of the most beautiful people I ever met.
There you go.
A little devil in his own way, but once met, never forgotten. Anne and Barry were just the best, says Siobhan. And please pass on my very good wishes to Anne Higgins. Anne was a teacher to my son Darren in special school in Baldoyle many years ago before she became principal there. She was fantastic to everyone. We remember Michael. And that's from Rosaline and Jonathan Egan. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and I know it's difficult, but he was obviously a very special teenager.
He really was.
And he had an effect on people.
He
touched people when he met them.
He really did.
Yeah.
He really, nobody can explain it, but I'm so glad that we discovered it. And I'm so glad that we enabled him to come out of his shell. Because he was in a shell for a long time, very quiet and reserved. And I'm so glad that we gave him the opportunity to actually he blossomed.
Mm.
And to see that strength and resilience and energy and love for life. I mean, I tell people this all the time. They'd be bored listening to me. But, not many people wake up in the morning giddy with excitement when there's actually nothing happening. And we would look at him and say, why are you so excited? He says, I'm just excited for my life. I mean, if we can all live by that.
Oh, yeah. Let's take a leaf out of Michael's book. That's the perfect way to end our chat.
And Anne's reminiscences about Michael are also the perfect way to end the programme. So thanks for listening. And bye-bye.